So, today I'd like to just cover one question on the quiz. Question one, there seemed to be some mistaken understandings there that we should clear up. Then we'll talk a little bit about, actually I forgot, there's another item here we need to talk about, which is open files versus file descriptors. And we'll just talk briefly about the status that wait returns, and then we'll get into virtual memory. So moving right along, last time we covered these topics here in the common shell pattern, and in general, what parent processes would do, which is to fork a child, then the child does an exec to become a new program, and the parent waits on it. And then we talked a little bit about what file descriptors are. We looked at some examples of redirection, including pipes, and that's where we wrapped up. So on question one, here's the code that we looked at. So presumably there's some parent that's calling this mystery function, and inside the mystery function, the parent is forking four times. So we've got the parent process, and it's going to have child 0, child 1, child 2, and child 3, right? Because we're forking here inside a for loop that iterates four times. And in the parent, this here is executing in the parent, we return the PID. You'll notice here that actually this loop is only going to iterate once in the parent. So because of the return here. So we actually only get one child, right? So conceptually what we did here with the for loop, these don't actually get forked because we enter this loop, we increment the count, we fork. If the return value of the fork is non-zero, we're in the parent, we return the PID, and by doing the return, we actually return from this function. So for A, once we're back in the parent, is it possible for the parent to wait on the PID of the child that it created? Yeah, right? So this return is returning the PID of the child that was created. Now the parent, where we call the mystery function, it gets this PID as the return value, and it can do a wait PID on that PID. And if we didn't have this funky case where we return after the first fork and we actually did the loop and created an array or something like we saw in a previous example and returned a pointer to that array or something, as long as the PIDs of the forks get returned to the parent somehow, it can wait on them. About item B, that count there is, of course, going to... question.
So does it still create, four children since the child process would fork again?
So in the child, yes, the child will create more processes. So the child here will have, let me pick a different color. So it won't execute this if here, and the child will loop back up to the top. But yeah.
So does that not count as one of the processes that the function call creates?
So the parent creates one child. Now, this child creates, let's call it a grandchild. And that grandchild will return, and it can wait. Sorry, the child will return, and it can wait on its grandchild. The grandchild will create a grand, what do you call that? A great-grandchild. And the grandchild can wait on the great-grandchild. But the way this is worded, it is possible for the process that calls this function, whether that's the parent or the child or the grandchild, to wait upon and output the exit status of the processes it creates. Yes?
Only the parent actually calls the function, right?
Well, remember, the child is a perfect copy of the parent. So the question was, for the recording, only the parent calls the function. But remember, the child has an exact copy of this code. So in the child case, the child will go up here after the first fork. Now we're in the child. We'll come along here. The child forks the grandchild. And in the child after that fork, the PID of the grandchild is going to be non-zero. So now the child will return from this function. And this child will be running an exact copy of the same code that the parent is running. So that child returns from this function, and now it can, in the calling code, it can do the wait. So you have this kind of nesting of parent calls child and waits, child creates grandchild and waits, grandchild creates grandchild and waits. And so trying to recognize this pattern here is what we were trying to get you to see. It's tricky, I agree. But, and then semantically, we were sort of being a little lawyerly here where we say, it's possible for a given process that calls this function to wait upon the processes it creates. So the parent is waiting on the child that it created, the child is waiting on the grandchild that it created, and so on. Yes? So the we say it is possible. That doesn't mean that it has to. But conceptually, the calling code, just to avoid confusing things here, since I used red for the child, I'll pick a different color. The calling code looks like this. And then when we we have to capture the return value, so we capture the PID, and then we can do what we want with that. It is possible now, possible to call wait PID here. So the parent is doing some stuff, it calls mystery to get into this code that's shown here. When that code returns, we capture the return value here. Now we have the PID available to do a wait on it if we want. Yes?
So is A assuming that we're only considering the direct child, none of the grandchildren?
Yes.
How can that be assumed from the way it's written though? Because it's saying all the processes that this function creates, doesn't that kind of imply any direct or indirect?
I understand what you and the previous student were getting at, but the way that I think you should think about this, and I think the way that it would typically be interpreted is, you create a process when you call fork, And then if that child creates other processes, you didn't create it. It is one of your descendants, but you didn't actually directly create it. And here's why I would argue that that's the right interpretation. That child could call exec. And that child could then do other stuff. It could even call exec again. You don't really know, as the parent, what that child might be doing. And so you don't really have a notion that you created it in the program code. Now, there is this inheritance here where have this parent-child-grandchild tree, but you're typically not going to directly wait on a grandchild. There is an exception for a code, for a shell to clean up a zombie, but that's kind of a side issue. But, I mean, aside from sort of points on the quiz, the important thing here is to understand what's going on. And for B, where there were also, I think, some misconceptions, the assembly code for the count increment is, the question here talks about dereferencing a pointer since the location where the count is stored is different in different processes. In terms of the way that the process is created is an exact copy. Actually, in the virtual address space of each of those copies, the parent, the child, the grandchild, that count variable is at exactly the same virtual address as an offset from the stack pointer in each of those copies. So, we have the parent here, and the stack is growing downwards, and here's count. And when we fork, the child is an exact copy, and count will be at the same location in its stack. And so this is what we were trying to test whether you were recognizing here in part B. In a similar way, let's suppose that I, the value of I, the loop iterator here, is kept in a register. So when you fork, you create an exact copy, including the register values. So if this is here, virtual memory, we also have some registers. Here's I, and when we fork, we create a copy of the registers, and here's I. And then for D, what happens if fork fails? Just returns a negative value. And actually, the way this code is written, we don't handle the return. We don't handle the negative, the error condition. We just return the value of PID, whether it's a positive or negative number. As long as the PID is not zero when we're in the child, we're just returning that. And we don't really know what the parent does with that. E is really getting at the same thing that B and C were getting at, which is that the child is an exact copy. So when this mystery function returns in the parent, we pop the stack. And so the stack pointer might move from here to here. Now, when the child returns, after it got forked, it's running in the same function. It has an exact copy of the stack. When it returns, it had the same stack pointer. It's going to pop the stack pointer by the same amount. And by the way, actually, Just to get picky here, the stack pointer would actually be here, pointing to the end of the stack, not at the ahead of count. But the point here is that the stack is a copy in the parent and the child. And when you return, you're running the same code. So part of the return protocol from a function is to pop the stack and restore the stack pointer to where it was. In both the parent and the child, that will then move the stack pointer up to this point right here, where the mystery function call has returned, and we're assigning the return value to this variable in the calling code. Yes, question.
Say you were to, after you called for, if you were to modify the parent process again, would those changes in the parent process be reflected in the child process, or are they not concurrently shared?
So the question was, after the fork, if the parent makes any change to its state, would the child be affected in any way? And the answer is no. Once the child is copied, it's a completely independent process. It is an exact copy, but other than sharing open files through the inheritance of the file descriptors, where you would see changes, we use that property for redirection. But except for that, they're completely independent. And anything that the parent writes to memory, the child will not see. If the parent closes its file descriptor, that won't affect the child's ability to access the open file through its copy of the file descriptor. And that actually is probably a good segue to the next point. So I think in the interest of time, we should move on. If you have more questions about this, certainly feel free to contact us after class or put on Piazza or come to office hours or anything like that. Overall, on the other questions, people seem to understand the material pretty well, and so we're not going to go over the remaining questions. So regarding open files and file descriptors, when a process is forked, it inherits the parent's file descriptors. The child inherits the parent's file descriptors. And we use that for redirection and for setting up pipes. And we looked at examples of that last week. And so you can go back and look at those slides if you're hazy on how we take advantage of this property. But it inherits the parent's file descriptors. And incidentally, they're also inherited across an exec call. So even after you exec, if let's say you've redirected standard in or standard out, the exec program in the child process will still see those inherited file descriptors that have been redirected. That's essential to the way redirection works. What's actually happening here is that, I'm trying to figure out where to draw. I didn't plan the slide very well, but I'll do it down here. There's an open file table that's system-wide. And so it has keyboard, terminal, maybe output.txt, and then the parent has a file descriptor table, and so conventionally, 0, the input goes to the keyboard, 1, the output goes to the terminal, and we can redirect the output and instead have it go to a text file. That's the redirection that we looked at. Now, in a child, it inherits the parent file descriptor table at whatever in whatever state it was. So let's say we did it before redirection. So the child would point to the standard in would point to the keyboard, and its output would point to the terminal, and they're pointing to the same places in this open file table. And so now, after the fork, if the parent closes standard out and redirect standard out to this output file, the child doesn't see that. But the parent could even close these file descriptors here, and there would be no impact on the child because the child still has these green pointers into the open file table. And only when the last file descriptor in use that's accessing an item in the open file table, only when the last file descriptor is closed do we actually close the specific file. So like parent only is the only thing pointing to output.txt, so when it closes this file descriptor, output.txt gets closed. But let's say we had another file here that both the child and the parent were sharing, and that might be a pointer to a pipe. When the parent closes its end of the pipe and the child still has that end of the pipe open, that pipe remains. And so that's the second point here. The third point is that all the created or copied file descriptors that are related to a specific open file share a seek pointer. The seek pointer is Unix terminology for your position in accessing the file. So if the parent and the child are both reading and writing to a file, the current position in that file will move and they'll both see that change. On the other hand, separate calls to open are completely separate. So after the fork, if the parent opens a file and the child opens a file, those are completely separate. They won't see any effect from each other. Even in the very same process, if you open the same file twice, those file descriptors are unrelated to each other. So let's look at an example. Suppose we have this code. If the file foo.txt contains the characters A and B, really short file, and we open that file twice, and there was a typo here, these read calls should be FD1 and FD2. So if we read FD1 and put the byte that we read into C, and then we read FD2 and put the byte that we get with FD2 into D, and then print the results, they will both be A. Because FD1, here's foo.txt, A, B. FD1, the seek pointer for FD1 starts here. We read A, and now the seek pointer is here. Now for FD2, let me pick a different color. The seek pointer starts here. We read a byte, and that advances the seek pointer to here. So this is just trying to make the point that these two reads are independent. Now let's look at a different example. Supposing same file, we open the file, and now we dump that file descriptor into a new file descriptor, entry 100. So we have the FD table here. Let's say FD is somewhere over here, and here's FD 100, and we've made a copy. And here's our open file table. And we have an entry here for foo.txt. When we do the open here, we associate this file descriptor with that file. So this is the open. When we do the dup here, that makes this file descriptor a copy that points to the same open file. So now if we do these two reads using these two different file descriptors, because these file descriptors point to the same open file, one is a copy of the other, then in our file AB, the first read, let's follow the seek pointer. The seek pointer starts here. The The first read gets A, and the seek pointer gets advanced. And then the next read gets B, and the seek pointer gets advanced. So where is the seek pointer for an open file stored? The seek pointer is in the open file table associated with each open file. And because these two file descriptors share that slot, they see each other's changes to the seek pointer. So let's look at an example across a fork. If we do a fork after we've opened the file, and the child reads from that file descriptor, and the parent reads from that file descriptor, it doesn't matter what order they read, actually. One will read the first character, and the other one will read the next character. In this case, we have, because of the sleep here, we have the parent reading second, so it's the parent that will get the second character of the file. But in this case, our FD table of the parent and our FD table of the child are copies, right? So the parent has the FD here that points to the open file table foo.txt. And then when we do the fork, the child gets a copy of the file descriptors. So any questions so far? Okay. So let's move on and briefly finish up talking about wait. I didn't really get to talk about the status. So in main, when you return from main, you are returning the value that the wait call will see as the status. This value here is what actually gets returned as the status. So you'll remember I said that when a process is launched, there's actually some stub code that's in the file crt.o that gets linked that does the call to main. And when main returns in that code, that stub code takes that value and calls exit with it. And the return status is actually, is what gets provided as the argument to the system call exit. So when you return from main in that stub code that called main, it's actually just calling exit. If you called exit directly from your program at any point in the program, the argument that you provide to exit is going to be what wait sees as the status. If your program crashes, the OS internally basically calls exit on behalf of the crashed process with a value indicating a failure. So when you call wait, remember this here gets filled in by the kernel. And now you can inspect that value. You can just printf it if you want. And sort of the convention is that when you return zero, that means the process exited successfully. But you can also be a little more sophisticated and use these helper functions that are defined in the Linux code. These are just macros that do various things on the status object. So wifexited just tests whether the value exited normally by calling exit itself or whether it crashed. And you can print the exit status by using this exit status macro. That's the cleaner way to do it. The status will also let you know if the process got signaled, and you can inspect that using that W macro and so on. That's really all there is to it. The status is, We know it's just an int, but these macros use the kind of the conventions on what those status values mean, what those ints mean, to provide a cleaner notation for manipulating that status value that gets returned by the kernel. Any questions? Okay, so let's change gears and talk about virtual memory. So remember that we said that every process gets its own virtual address space from zero to the max address. And we want that because we don't want a process to be dependent in any way on what other programs are running, where this particular process got mapped in memory. We want to be able to interleave chunks of the program in physical memory to use available slots and so on. So these here are virtual addresses. And the convention is that we load, there's a little bit of extra information down here, but we basically load the code segment at the bottom of the address space. So it'll be at something like 0x, 0 something, 1, blah, blah, blah. The next segment right above that in the virtual address space is the data segment, global data, data that's pre-allocated when the program starts. I should mention here the constants that are just defined as specific numbers, not variables, in the program code will be part of the actual code segment. They're not writable, right? A constant should be constant. So I should mention that this here is read-only. So we have our global data segment. That's where all our global values live. Then we have our heap on top of that. Then the stack is at the top of the user accessible virtual address space. So that would be 0x7f, blah, 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 blah. And remember, the stack grows down towards smaller addresses, while the heap grows up toward larger addresses. So the layout of this is used in many operating systems because it has the nice property that you can allow the heap and the stack to grow quite a lot before you risk having them run into each other. And if your address space is large enough, it would be pretty rare that they would actually bump into each other. And we can put the heap on top of the data segment and have it grow up because those global variables, we know how many there are. We know how much space they take up. So we can sort of pre-allocate space for that. We don't need to allocate any extra space for the global data. And then any other data that's created will either be pushed onto the stack or malloced on the heap. Now, there's an exception here that we won't get into yet, but when you have multiple threads, each thread gets its own thread private stack. So we might actually need to allocate multiple stack segments here, each with kind of space to grow down. And obviously that works better if you have a large enough address space that you can kind of spread these stacks out through that available area. But for now, let's stick to the single-threaded model where we have one heap and one stack. So let's say we have multiple processes. Each of them thinks that they have this whole address space, but in fact, we can divide this address space into chunks, and we're going to call those pages, and allocate each of those chunks anywhere in memory that's available. So when process A starts up, we might allocate that page up there and put the code in it. And let's say that the code is small enough to fit in one page. So we've got one slot there. And then we'd allocate the data somewhere. If there's a big chunk of contiguous pages, maybe they get laid out together, but the point here is they don't need to be. Each of these chunks here can actually be spread out. And in fact, each of these segments here, heap, stack, and so on, can be divide it up into these chunks called pages, and each of those pages can live in different places in physical memory. The process doesn't know. The process only sees its own virtual address space. It doesn't care where these chunks are laid out in memory. By the way, this top part here, the memory that's used by the operating system, by convention, it gets the top half of memory. So basically that most significant bit, whether it's a 7 or an F, that really means that the very most significant bit is either a 0 or a 1. So anything from 0x8000 all the way up to 0xFFFFFF is reserved for the operating system's data structures. And in fact, there's just one copy of the operating system, but it's mapped into each process's address space. And so we see that here with the dotted line, that both A and B virtual address ranges point to the same piece of physical memory. Maybe it's broken into different chunks, but they're pointing to the same places in physical memory. So let's say we've got the function here, the system call sleep and the code that's associated with that. That's going to be shared by all the processes. And let's say we have a process table that keeps the state of the processes. That's going to be a place in memory that is mapped into each of these processes. So any questions so far? Yes.
So given that you said like half of the memory is typically reserved for the OS, does that mean for a given process you can't allocate more than half of the system's memory generally?
You can't allocate more than half. So the size of the virtual address space and the size of physical memory can be different. But, and it could be larger or smaller, it can be either way. But within your virtual address space, any given process can only allocate half of that virtual address space. So for example, if we have a 32-bit address space, we have 2 to the 32 byte addresses, which means we have 4 gigabytes of virtual address space. So we can allocate, the possible set of virtual addresses goes from 0 to 4 gig. The user level process can only allocate from 0 to 2 gig. And then the top 2 gig is reserved for the OS. So this gives the process the illusion that it has dedicated memory, and there's only one set of mappings that is active when a given process is running on a core. So if A is the one that's been scheduled and is running on the core, the green mappings are the ones that are active. And that virtual address set of mappings, we'll talk about how that's actually represented, that's what's on the processor and in use. And the virtual address mappings for B have been swapped off of the processor and stored in the OS state where it keeps track of information about each active process, like the register values that that processor uses. Now, when there's a context switch for whatever reason and B is scheduled, we'll take the address mappings for A and set them aside and activate the address mappings for B. And now the blue mappings will be the ones that are active. Notice that in either case, the OS is mapped, right? Because they both have these dotted lines that are active. The green dotted line points to the same places in memory as the blue. So that's how they're able to share the operating system code and data. Because any active process will map those addresses up here to the same places in physical memory, and it acts like shared memory. Not to put too fine a point on it, but when you did the shared memory allocation in your lab, you were actually allocating a chunk of memory over here. And mapping it into both processes, right? So that way when process A allocates its virtual addresses that are assigned to that shared memory object, it's going to the actual physical place in memory here. And then when process B accesses its own virtual addresses that were assigned to the shared memory object, it's going to access the same physical location in memory. So what address translation does is it takes the virtual addresses and converts them into physical locations in memory. So this has to be done for every address that the process uses. So every time the program counter changes, when you move from one assembly instruction in the program to the next one, or when you do a jump, whatever, every single time the program counter is used, which means every time you execute an assembly language instruction, that's a virtual address that points to the code segment. And we have to translate that to get to the correct place. We don't want to end up in B's code or in somebody's data segment. So we have to have a way to map that. And every time we do a load or a store, that's a virtual address. And it'll go to the correct process's data segment or heap or stack or whatever. So I mentioned that the virtual address space and the physical address space can be different sizes. So you can buy a computer, well, let's take kind of the older computers that had 32-bit address spaces. You can buy, you know, 20 years ago, you could buy an Intel x86 processor that was a 32-bit processor, and the virtual addresses covered 4 gig. But the computer you bought back then rarely had 4 gig. That was super expensive. It often only had 1 or 2 gig. Not a problem. We've got a certain number of physical pages. The operating system is responsible for mapping virtual addresses to valid locations in physical memory. If there are too many processes running, trying to use more places in memory than we actually have space for in physical memory, we have a way to deal with that in the operating system. And the way is we actually take some piece of memory that the program's not using, copy it out to disk, and then make that vacated piece of physical memory available for the process that needs it. And so virtual memory is sometimes kind of misused as a term to refer to this idea that you can have a smaller physical memory and push stuff out to disk when you're not using it and bring it back. That's a capability that's enabled by virtual memory. But what we really mean by virtual memory, the correct definition of this term, is that the virtual address space that the user level code sees is distinct from the physical locations in memory where those code and data items actually reside. And that mapping is hidden from the process. The process can't see it, with a minor exception that we'll see in a minute, but the process can't see that, and that's managed by the operating system. So this is stored in a combination of places in the processor and in the actual operating system memory, this set of mappings. And let's start looking at how this is actually implemented. So let's take a toy program memory, super tiny memory. We have 4 pages, and each of these pages is we have 2^8 bits equals of virtual address equals 64 bytes of space in each of these pages. So this first page goes from 000 to 00 11111111. And that left-hand binary representation, we're also showing the corresponding hex. So for this unit, you're going to get comfortable with hex to binary conversions if you're not already, for that whole 10-bit sequence. But so we've got 64 possible byte addresses in each of these virtual pages. And then we can number the pages. So the green page is page 0, the blue page is page 1, and so on and so forth. So what we've done here is we've divided our available virtual address space, our virtual view of memory, into fixed size chunks, that in this toy example are only 64 bytes, 2 to the 8th. And then we can number each of those pages. So the page number is this bit in red. It's the most significant bits of our address. And then the lower order bits are our page offset. That's our position within a page. So as we go from from here is address 0 up to address 63 in page number 0, we're just sort of moving up in our position within this page until we hit address 64. Well, address 64 is 01000000000. Because if we did a mod of 64, we'd basically be chopping off the lowest order 8 bits. 64 is 2 to the 8th. Mod is basically looking at, well, actually this would be div, right? But mod and div are basically operating, when you're talking about powers of 2, by looking at either the higher order or the lower order bits. So now, our physical memory can have more pages than our virtual address space. Can be bigger or smaller. So our physical addresses here, we've got 8 pages, not 4. So our page numbers are gonna have to be able to refer to 8 different physical pages. So we need 3 bits for that. So it'll go from 000 page number to 111. And sorry, I already covered that. And now when we allocate our virtual pages into physical memory, we can allocate them anywhere. It truly does not matter where we place a virtual page within the physical memory. There is no need for virtual pages that are contiguous, like adjacent pages in the stack, to be in the same place in physical memory. Because for every virtual address, we're going to translate that virtual address to find the corresponding place in memory. The only reason we would care is if different parts of the physical memory had different access latencies. And that is actually an active area of hardware research, but in every conventional computer, all the DRAM has the same latency, so it truly doesn't matter where you assign a virtual page in the physical memory. Question?
Why does the page number in the virtual address go from 2 bits to 3 bits in the physical address?
So the question here was, why is this virtual page number 2 bits and this physical page number is 3 bits? And the reason is that, you know, arbitrarily for this example, the virtual address space only allows for 4 pages. So we only need 2 bits for that. But we're running on a computer that has more physical memory than that, and the physical memory actually consists of 8 physical pages. So to name those 8 physical pages, we need 3 bits. We could do it the other way around. We could have a physical memory that only has 2 pages. And that would actually be problematic because we couldn't have all of the program state active at once. There'd be a lot of swapping back and forth to disk in that particular case. But in, if we only had two physical pages, then the physical addresses would only have one bit for the page number. So I've talked about this mapping. This mapping is actually capturing this. And that's stored in the operating system. And you'll notice here that virtual address, virtual page number 10 has not yet been mapped to physical memory. There's no arrow. So there's no mapping here. So we call this mapping the page table. And the page table is stored in the operating system memory. There's a separate page table for every process. When the process is running, the most recently used mappings are stored in a structure in the hardware called a translation look-aside buffer to make access fast, right? Because if we had to go read a mapping from memory for every assembly language instruction, that would be unbearably slow. But we can't store the entire page table in the hardware, it's too big. So that hardware structure keeps the most recently used mappings to speed up execution. But conceptually, you can think of it, as long as you're finding the mappings you need in that hardware structure, you can think of it as if the entire page table is available instantaneously every time you do a load or a store, or every time you use the program counter to read an instruction. So let's do a toy page table lookup. So let's take an address from our example, and the top two order bits in purple are our virtual page number. And the lower order green bits are our offset. So the virtual page number here is, let me just catch up with where I am in my notes here. Those high order bits are going to index a slot in my page table. We call that a page table entry. And that page table entry, in addition to giving the physical page number, will tell us whether that particular entry is valid. So in our example back here, the 10 entry was not valid, whereas the other three were. And the way we actually represent that is with this valid bit here that tells us whether an entry is active or not. So when we're decoding an address, we take the physical, we take the virtual page number from the address, we look up the corresponding slot, and the first thing we do is we check that bit to see if that slot contains a valid mapping. If not, then we trigger an exception. Otherwise, we just append the offset to the physical page number, and that gives us our physical address. Now, the annotation here of whether it's code data or stack, that's not stored in the page table. That's just to sort of refer back to earlier in our example. And so that here is the address that we'll send to memory. And we've covered all this. So it's important to note here that the offset is used unchanged. We just strip it off and separate it from the virtual page number, and then we append it to the physical page number. And the reason that works is that within one page, the position that a particular byte is that you're trying to access is the same, right? If you're accessing the zeroth byte within a page in your virtual address space, it's also going to be the zeroth byte in the physical page, because these are fixed size chunks. They're the same size chunks in the virtual land or physical land. So in most systems, your virtual address size is going to be the size of a pointer. So on a 64-bit system, which is probably what all of your laptops are, a pointer is an 8-byte value, 64 bits. And you typically call those ints, but it doesn't really matter. It's 64 bits. But that's a humongous address space. So 2 to the 30 is a gigabyte. 2 to the 40 is a petabyte. 2 to the 64 is a huge number. I actually don't know what that is in the Greek numbering system off the top of my head. But hardly any process is ever going to use that much virtual address space, even if it's mapping pretty large files, because disks aren't that big. So some of that virtual address space is unused, and we also can't physically build a computer with that much physical memory. So what the humongous address space of 64 bits gives us is, first of all, to build the hardware efficiently, we want pointers to be powers of 2. And so the next thing after 32 is 64. Secondly, that actually has the nice property that we can really spread out the address space of the process and have multiple stacks for different threads and map files, and there's still lots of empty space around them, and they're not going to collide with each other in the virtual address space. And so when we talked about how the OS is in the top half of the address space, well, okay, so we really only have 63 bits that we can use in the user level virtual address space. That's still more than enough. Question?
So in the multi-core processors, where you're running multiple processes at the same time, are there just two different virtual mappings that
Yes. So the question was, what happens in multi-core when you have multiple processes running? So on each core in the system, they're sharing physical memory, but each of those processes, let's assume they're separate processes, they're not separate threads, then each of those processes will have its own active virtual to physical mapping. And what's actually stored on the processor is a pointer to that particular process's page table. So there's a special register that the operating system loads when it does a context switch, which is a base pointer to the beginning of that process's page table in memory. So when you do a context switch, new process comes on, new pointer. You have multiple cores, each of them has its own pointer to that process's page table. Now suppose that some of those cores are running threads from the same process. Well, then on each of those cores, that pointer will be to the same page table. Because remember, threads share memory. So physical memory is not going to be anywhere near 64 bits worth of physical address space. Intel x86-64 actually only allows the physical address to be 48 bits. And even that is something that we can't really physically build. That's kind of made a large number to allow for future growth in the capacity of memory. So if this is 64 and this is only 48, that means that there's some bits in the virtual address that aren't used. The OS is the one creating the mapping, so it can make sure that the bits in the virtual address that don't have any correspondence that it can't use are just never used. So it's helpful to be comfortable with your powers of 2. So a 32-bit virtual address space gives you 2 to the 32 bytes of virtual address space, which is 4 gigabytes. A 20-bit address space gives you 2 to the 20 byte addresses, which is 1 megabyte. It's also important to note that all of these memories are byte addressable. So every address, when you increment by 1, you're moving by 1 byte in the address space, whether it's virtual or physical. So when you move by a word, like an 8-byte int, So if you do pointer arithmetic on an int pointer and you increment by one, that pointer arithmetic in C is actually incrementing the address by 8 bytes. We talked about that earlier in the class. So if your machine has less physical memory than the actual physical address, then the hardware knows not to use the physical addresses that correspond to memory that's not populated in your machine. So if you have a 2 to the 48 physical address, let's say 2 to the 48 versus, this is going to be, we're only going to use 32 bits here. So this is... the OS knows not to use the high order 16 bits of the physical address when it's allocating physical memory for the process. It knows it's only got 32 bits. And by the way, it knows that it's actually only 3 gigabytes, so it knows that there's one of those bits there that can only ever be 0, can never be 1. So let's sort of practice our understanding here. Suppose we have 32-bit virtual addresses, and each page is 4 kbytes. This is x86-32's virtual address space, by the way. How many virtual pages are there? Well, we can just do 2 to the 32 divided by 2 to the 12, right? That's how many virtual pages there are. So this is... how many bytes, and this is how many bytes per page. So this gives us 2 to the 20 pages. How big is the page table if it's laid out like the ones we've seen? Well, we need an entry for each of those pages. We said there are 2 to the 20 pages. So we need 2 to the 20 entries. So this is 1 meg entries, and each entry is 19 bits. Well, we can't allocate chunks of 19 bits, so the next size that we could allocate would be 3 bytes. That's kind of awkward. So we're probably going to allocate 4 bytes. So 1 meg times 4 bytes is 4 megabytes per page table in a 32-bit processor. So you can imagine how large the page table is for a 64-bit processor. So we have to have ways to deal with that that we'll talk about later either the next lecture or the one after that. And I should specify here 19 bits is awkward. So allocate 4 bytes per entry. All right, next exercise. Let's split this address into page number and page offset. Well, 12 bytes is 3 hex positions here. Right, each hex number is 4 bytes. is 4 bits. So if we have 12 bits of offset, we need 3 hex digits to represent that offset. And the remaining high order bits are a virtual page number. So any pointer in this 32-bit virtual memory system with 4K pages, we can take the low order 12 bits or the low order 3 hex digits, and that's our offset. And the rest is our page number. And so we have 5 digits here, which is 20 bits. So This is our 20-bit virtual page number, and this is our 12-bit offset. So let's map this virtual address. Now we're going to go to a smaller representation for purposes of this example. Let's practice a page lookup. So we've got this virtual address down at the bottom. And by the way, it's sort of a convention when you're representing bits in these long strings to represent them in groups of four, because each of those groups of four bits corresponds to one hex number. It's just a sort of for readability. So this virtual address, 0x024, which corresponds to these bits, so like here's your four, here's your two. What is the physical address for that? So just to practice, let's take a minute and actually talk to your neighbors and figure out what the correct physical address for this is. And note here, we have 6-bit page offsets. So we're doing 64-byte pages, 2 to the 6th in this example. Okay, so I'll just go ahead and give the answer in the interest of time. 6-bit page offset here means that we're going to take these low order 6 bits. This is the offset. And this is our virtual page number. So we're going to look at this slot here, right? Virtual page number 000. And that's going to give us physical page number 0010. So our physical address is equal to 00101000. So this part goes here, and this part goes here. Remember, we always just take the offset and append it to the physical page number. So if you know how to do this, then you know how to do a page table lookup. And you understand how to take a virtual address and break it down to do that page table lookup. Now, there's more details and layers that we'll talk about later, but that's a really important core concept. Any questions? Okay, so there are other features that we can leverage here. Like, for example, if we have two copies of the same program, it's a waste of physical memory to have two copies of that using separate sets of physical pages, right? If we're running two copies of, let's say, VIM, we don't need two copies of it. We can actually just have one copy and share it between the two processes. So Vim copy one, the code segment, virtual addresses will point to some physical memory where Vim is stored, where the Vim code and global and constants are stored. And then Vim process 2, those virtual addresses will point to the same place. So they're shared. Now, what if one copy tries to modify its code? Now, in most cases, we don't allow that, but there are valid reasons why this could happen. And what happens if two processes are sharing the same read-only memory, like code, and one of them tries to modify it? Well, we don't want that to corrupt the other process's memory. So we have permission bits. And the permission bits include not only that we store in the page table, include not only the valid bit that we talked about earlier, but also whether that page is writable. So if we just don't want to allow a process to modify its code, we could set this write bit to 0. And then that page is just not writable, period. We can also make a note here of whether it's executable. So we shouldn't be able to execute bytes from any random page in memory. We only want valid code to be executable. So we can make a note of that in the page table. We can also separate user and OS pages. So if there's a 1 here, this is a user accessible page. If it's a 0, it's a page that's mapped by the operating system and the user can't access it. There's a question here. Let's see here. So we talked a little bit about OS memory being up there at the top. Next I want to talk about, next I want to talk about allocating memory on demand, and then once we get through this, we'll stop for the day. So the stack can, remember, I drew that picture. Oh, it's here. The stack here can grow down, and this could actually be a lot of memory that's available. And what we want to avoid is that we're allocating physical memory that's not currently in use. So once we have the notion of paging, we can allocate space on demand. So in this example here, we're pushing something on the stack using the push. The stack pointer here is currently pointing at this address, this page number. So here's the virtual page number, and here's the offset. So we're doing really tiny pages just for illustrative purposes. And if we, and remember the stack grows down, right? So if we're at 0x7FFFC000 and we try to push, we actually have to decrement the stack pointer. And that means we're gonna go down to 0x7FFFBFFF as our next byte, and so on and so forth. And the push is going to access a page here that hasn't been allocated. So that page table might look like this, where the valid bit for that stack address is currently 0 and there's nothing mapped here. But that's okay. The OS knows that the stack is simply trying to grow. So when you first try to do the push, it will generate a page fault because there's no valid mapping. The OS will say, oh, you're accessing stack. I can allocate a page for that. So I'll allocate a page, like in the red rectangle here. And then remember, when we return from an exception, we can redo the operation. So we'll just try that push again. Now we have allocated memory, and the push will succeed. So I think this is a good place to stop, and let me just say, so the key feature here is that we can save memory by only allocating the memory when it's actually used. And this is one of the many features, some of which we've already talked about, that virtual memory provides. All right, thanks everyone.